This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and Indie Book Publishing. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today we'll be visiting with author Dr. Allison Willis to discuss her book, Nurturing Intelligence, How to Encourage Learning and Develop Capacity. This is released through Balboa Press. Welcome, Dr. Willis.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Jay.
I was curious. This book, although not a large book, just over 60 pages, almost 70, it talks about your visit to Uganda, a trip that you took with some very young children. Most of us in the Western world think of Uganda as a very dangerous place. Why did you make that trip?
Well, it was a research trip from the outset. We were there to visit friends. We had some interests with aid and development projects over there. And I was conducting research with my local university here on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, Australia. And it was kind of a bit of a family holiday, and it's probably not the most obvious place to take young children on a family holiday, but it was absolutely life-changing. We will never be the same again. We will never see the world the same way ever again, and we wouldn't change the experience for anything.
Well, your book says this, fixed mindsets are not limited to the gifted. What do you mean by that statement?
Oh, yes. No, fixed mindsets that's a condition that any of us can suffer from. You know, at the point where we decide that our potential is limited and that there is an end to our capacity to grow, that's where we develop a fixed mindset. I did not coin that phrase. Dr. Carol Dweck from the US coined that phrase, but it resonates with people all around the world. Our fixed mindset is not just limited to somebody who thinks that they were born smart or born dumb. It's sort of part of the human condition. Many, many times in different areas of our lives, we can make a decision that from that point on limits our growth just by virtue of thinking, you know, well, I'm not good at that. And so when we attach that little bit of information that says, I'm not good at maths, or I'm not good at travel, or I'm not good at whatever it may be, when we attach that little piece of information to our understanding and our knowledge, we then, from that point onwards, we limit the growth of that knowledge any further.
You also talk in your book about higher order thinking, and of course the top of that is create. Or creative, the top side is create,
yeah.
And the bottom, remember. What does that mean?
Yeah. So when we're looking at the development of knowledge and when we're looking at the development of understanding schemes in our mind and the way that we recall information and the way that we then use information and apply it, we're looking at the basic level. The bottom level is building your knowledge about things, building your knowledge about numeracy or your knowledge about literacy or your knowledge about science or whatever the field may be. And we see this in young children all the time. They accommodate new information. They accumulate new information all the time. But as we get a little bit older and a little bit more mature, we start to take information from previous experiences and apply it to new situations. And then hopefully the plan is that the older we get, the more we mature through our teenage years and then into adulthood, and hopefully continue to mature and develop and grow, that we start to bring pieces of information together. So, for example, you might be starting to synthesize information that you perhaps learnt in high school about a particular scientific topic, and then you might have to bring that with your experience in your young adult years, and perhaps you might then bring it together with some other information about your health, for example, in your 30s, 40s, and things like that. And then when you then are in a position to synthesize information, to pull information together over your lifetime, you're then in a position to be able to come up with perhaps a new idea, maybe a new angle on a topic, or maybe something that somebody has not thought of before. And they talk about this, education researchers and leaders talk about this capacity to respond to new situations or novel situations as fluid intelligence. So it's not just your ability to problem solve according to a formula, but it's your ability to problem solve according to a new situation that you've never come across before. And you have the capacity to draw upon that lower order thinking, all that knowledge, all those schemes that you've built up over the years, that you've applied over the years, that you've synthesized over the years, to actually then create perhaps a new product, perhaps a new service, perhaps a new way of thinking about things.
What was your motivation in writing this book?
What was my motivation? I wrote this, it's a little bit of an overflow of my research in northern Uganda after researching children in the war zone. And then previous to that, I had researched student performance in Finland, which is one of the top performing countries in the world in international comparative studies. And then having worked with children and adults, having worked in developed and non-developing contexts, it's a bit of an intersection. Nurturing Intelligence, the book, kind of pulls together all of that. In Australia, and I'm sure in the US, I'm positive in the US, you have a lot of trends, you know, a lot of educational trends that come and go, and often they come and go with political decisions and policy and things, and we need policy writers to be making good education decisions. But sometimes they are on the back of an election campaign or a re-election or whatever it might be. And we see many fads come and go in education, in schools, in tertiary institutions. And when all of that fades, if all of that faded away, my question was, well, what is the human condition of learning? When we look at children in poverty and we look at children in advantaged and wealthy situations, when we look at adults, when we look at children, when we look at different culture and different socioeconomic situations, what does this all boil down to? What is the human condition of learning? And that was my motivation to write the book. At the time, I felt like I was in a position to do some of that synthesizing, to actually be pulling together some information from my various experiences in research and in practice in the classroom with my own children, being a mother, and also as a lecturer at a university, and being able to pull that all together and say, okay, so what is the human condition of learning? And I really have tried to capture that to the best of my ability in Nurturing Intelligence.
Did anything surprise you or shock you when you went to Uganda and began visiting with children? Are there educational skills or their ability to learn? Is it similar to other children in the world?
Oh, absolutely, it's similar. You know, they are beautiful children who have hopes and dreams just like any other child in any other country. And I probably was most struck by the human condition of learning. You know, learning is not a lesson or a curriculum. Learning is not even going to school. Learning is something we do because we're human. And these kids, regardless of how the education system is needing a lot of a bit of an injection of intellectual capital and economic capital just because of the war, even though that's the case, these kids were still learning. They were learning, and sadly, sometimes they were learning survival skills. You know, sometimes they were learning how to cook dinner at a really young age because they don't have a mum or dad anymore. And so that's probably one of the deepest lessons I learned by going to northern Uganda, that learning is actually a human condition, and that a healthy child learns and grows in a healthy environment. And if the environment's not healthy, if it's not conducive to positive growth, then a child is not going to develop as well as they could have otherwise.
Your book has some absolutely outstanding and gorgeous photos, as well as some great text. Who do you think this book would appeal to and why?
Yeah, I did. There's photos all through it, and I've written it for busy parents. I've written it for parents who want to understand how their children learn, I've written it for parents who are concerned about the future of their children and what life's going to look like and how on earth can I prepare my child for a future with all these technological advances that I can't keep up with. And most of those kinds of parents, those parents that are thinking about the future, they're busy. You know, they have jobs and they have commitments and they have commitments in their communities. You know, they're involved in community groups. And so I wanted to create a product for parents who are busy that they can just easily pick up and put down and not feel guilty about putting it down, but easily pick it up again. So I think most chapters are 2 or 3 pages long and there's pictures on every other page because I wanted it to be accessible and I wanted it to be a guilt-free product so that parents can access the information they need. It's quite concise. There's not a lot of long-winded explanations in nurturing intelligence. And that's done deliberately. I've deliberately created a product in that way for busy parents.
The photos are striking. I was noticing that there might be some controversial aspects to your book, even though it's short. Do you see anything in there, or have you written anything that might be controversial?
Oh, you know, anything to do with children could be controversial. I could say something about technology, and that could be controversial. I could say something about childhood development and intelligence, and that could be controversial. You know, the topic of children and parenting and raising children is incredibly personal for all people, and it should be. And it should be open to debate. So, yeah, I agree with you that people may take some things controversially. What stands out to you?
I wanted to get your perspective on media and on technology. What do you think about those two areas? Are they controversial or are they something that we need to be concerned about?
I really do believe that we need to keep moving. I really think that the technology wave is something that we should endeavour to ride. We have a lot of surf here on the Sunshine Coast where I live in Australia, and you are much safer in the surf if you know how to manage the waves, if you know how to ride the waves, and if you know how to just cope with a big wave that's coming rather than panic. You know, if you panic, you're at risk of drowning. And I feel it's the same with technology. And so we're looking at putting in managerial strategies and techniques to teach children how to manage their use of technology, how to cope with things that come via the media, images or ideas that come via the media. And so that's teaching children how to be mature. Now, obviously, there's age-appropriate exposure that parents will need to decide upon, and they should be making those decisions. And then at a time, there will be, you know, when children have their own devices and they will be given autonomy and they will increasingly take responsibility for their own use of technology. What I talk about in Nurturing Intelligence is in terms of technology, is when children become addicted to technology, which they can. Dr. Gary Small talks about that in his book, iBrain. Professor John Medina talks about that in his book, Brain Rules. When children become addicted to technology, they are limiting the neurological development of their brains. And so we've got to be careful that technology is something that we ride, that we're not swamped by, that does not ride us. You know, we've got to remember that we're the ones on the surfboard, not the technology. You know, the wave is the technology. We want to be in charge of this wave, not have the wave take charge of us.
Absolutely. Now, the greatest gift you can give a child, what do you think that is as a parent and as an educator?
Oh, the greatest gift. This is going to sound incredibly cliched, but I just resolutely believe that the greatest gift that you can give a child is unconditional love. When I was sitting under a mango tree in northern Uganda, talking to teachers that work with children who are hungry, whose families are dying of HIV/AIDS, who have lost loved ones in the war, you know, over half the population in northern Uganda is under the age of 15. Mm. And when I was talking to teachers there, At one point I stopped and I just said to this young teacher who was, you know, young children, you know, they would be the preschool prep kind of 6-year-old age group. I said, how do you do it? These kids are hungry. they're sick, they don't have food to go home to, they don't have parents to go home to. And I know it sounds incredibly cliched, but it was just so incredibly true. She said, "We just love them." And that was the way that was their first response to post-traumatic stress, to depression, to learning difficulties, to hunger, to love them. And, of course, they fed them food at school and provided them with water as well. So, yeah, so I would absolutely believe that the greatest thing that a parent can give a child is unconditional love. And even though it sounds cliched, sometimes it's easier said than done. You know, sometimes our children are, as I said before, parenting is incredibly personal. And sometimes our children can be what we perceive to be a reflection of our own self, our reflection of our own parenting. You know, was my gene pool strong enough? And we just sometimes need to release our children of that pressure and just love them for who they are and love them for who they've been created to be.
Absolutely.
And love them for the potential. Love them for the potential that's inside of them. Yeah.
Although there may be similar books in the marketplace, what sets your book apart from the rest?
How is mine different? It's short, and it's deliberately short. It also draws upon years of experience, both as a teacher and as a researcher. Any parent can write a book about parenting and children, and I applaud them. But I believe that I'm in a unique position because of my research background and because of my professional experience. So I hope that I know that this book is research-driven and it's evidence-based. And I know that parents are busy and that they want something that they can access really quickly and it's meaningful. So that's what I hope is the standout qualities of nurturing intelligence.
Your book ends with this well-known quote, "And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love." And that taken from scriptures in 1 Corinthians 13:13. So you do recap that aspect that love is the most important thing you can give a child.
Absolutely. I really do believe that. You know, the book up until that point presents quite a lot of learning theory. It presents quite a lot of research. It presents quite a lot of things that are really take home, you know, principles that we can apply to raising children. But when it all comes down to it, if you haven't got that resolute conviction that a child is incredibly valuable and that your unconditional love can actually change their perspective on things, it can fortify them on a tough day. It can strengthen them when they're facing a tough decision. Esteem comes from the family. Esteem comes from the community that you belong to. You know, we can be so preoccupied with self-esteem in the West, but our self-esteem is a direct product of the health of the environments that we live in, the community groups that we run in, the family that we belong to. And so the power of love is incredible.
Exceptional advice. We've been visiting with Dr. Allison Willis, author of the book, Nurturing Intelligence. This is a Balboa publication. Dr. Allison, where can we get a copy of your book?
Oh, you can go to Balboa's website at bookstore.balboa.com, and it's available in soft copy, which is my recommendation because there's so many images and pictures, but it's also available as an ebook.
Your book sounds inspirational, and it certainly is a short read, so even someone with a short attention span like me could enjoy it. The photos are wonderful.
Hopefully. Absolute pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you, Dr. Allison Willis. And hope to hear from you in the future. Are you planning any other books?
Oh, there's always a next project in the back of my mind. Absolutely. I feel like I need to do this one justice first, but absolutely.
We look forward to hearing from you in the future. Thank you for sharing information with us. And for C. Jorgensen, Indie Books, and Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Parker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station?
Here come old flat top. Here come grooving up slowly. Got juju eyeball. He won. Holy roller.
Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Connect with Juliana and connect with what lies beneath. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Juliana is a marriage, family, and child therapist who wants people to connect. Connect with what lies beneath, those truths and answers. And through her counseling practice, she has helped others find their personal power and fulfill their dreams. And she wants to do the same for you here on Connect with Juliana. Through intimate discussions, intriguing subject matters, and the expertise of her guests. For more on the show and Juliana, check out her webpage. Connect with Juliana in media.com. Juliana will cover it all. Nothing is off limits. She wants to know what matters to you. Make the connection. Tune into TogiNet to connect with Juliana to find out the facts that could be hidden beneath the surface. Connect with Juliana on TogiNet to make a quality connection in your life. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Breath, The Ultimate Secret to Life. And the author is Mary Rose Wendels. And Mary Rose joins us all the way from Belgium on Indie Book Publishing. Hello, Mary Rose. How are you?
Hi, Steve. Thank you very much. I'm very well. And you? I put the coffee on hot.
Well, I guess we'll have to postpone that for a while, but it's great to have such a celebrated guest on our show today. First of all, Mary Rose, take us back, you know, before Breath, The Ultimate Secret to Life, which really is is daily breathing, breath yourself into heaven here on earth, as you put it. Breathing consciously, connected daily, will give you the life that you're looking for. So before all of this, before this incredible journey that you're on right now, you had an incredible journey before, too, in the world of music, very, very celebrated in the world of music. Tell us about before all of Breath.
Well, I had quite an interesting life because I started as an art teacher, and then went to work on television as a producer and a researcher, and then I got into the music. But working for someone else was very, very difficult for me, so I got to have my own business, which was Rose's Music. And I worked as a freelancer for different companies. And in that type of work, I met ABBA, I met Julio Iglesias, I made their first hits, Un Canto a Galicia, that was Julio, and Ring Ring was for ABBA, you know. But I had Gilbert O'Sullivan, I had Lindsay DePaul, Humperdinck, Tom Jones. I worked with all these people. It was crazy at that time. It was in the 60s, 70s, you know. So that was... very, very interesting life for me, preceding what I was doing later.
Right, but even with all that great success and the love of music and all that you were doing, you knew right from a very small girl, very young girl, that you had some special gifts.
Yes, I had very strong developed hand chakras, which gave me the opportunity to lay hands on. And it was my mother... that told me that was normal, because she said my mother did the same thing and she was the witch of the town, and I recognize it. So you have a gift. Be careful what you do with it. And then I started, I think I was 30 when I started learning 15 years with Japanese people how to work with that energy, and that was Mahikari. So I really learned how to handle it. And I seen in my whole life that I can actually use everything that I did in my life. I can use it in what I'm doing now.
You talk about physically alive forever, being physically alive forever. Now, obviously, that has a lot of deep meaning for you, and of course, you've reached this point where the breath of life is not only rejuvenating, it is it expands your whole consciousness.
It actually heals everything, because between my 22 and 28, being in the beginning in the business, I was a drunk. I drank as much as all the others drank, so I was drinking quite a lot, which hurt a lot of my brain. I burned a lot of bridges from my left and my right brain going together. So I reinstalled all that with the breath work. And when I talk about being alive forever, other people call it being immortal. I call it being alive forever because it's by choice. If you keep on breathing, you keep on living. I'm now for about 35 years without any medication. I don't take anything. I do take vitamins, and I eat a lot of fruit and a lot of veggies, but I do not take any medical drugs. And I know that everything that I got, I was severe asthmatic, I had severe eczema, all the other, I was a drunk, and all that left. I smoked like a Turk, we say, and all that left my system. It just left my system by breathing. Every day I do breathe one session of an hour and a half. So
tell us a little bit about this session, or this breathing session. What exactly do you do?
Well, when you come to breathe with me, I ask you to lay down. You lay down, and you breathe consciously connected through the nose as long as you can do that. Very often, when you get emotional, your nose gets very snotty, and you can't breathe anymore. And then you breathe through the mouth. So you finally over-oxygenate your body. And that means you get an overdose of oxygen. And that puts you in a very numb state where your body gets quite spastic, but still bearable, because you're the whole time with me. I'm the whole time. I'm singing for you. I'm doing mantras. I'm laying hands on while you're breathing. I'm doing didgeridoo, all to make it possible for you to go through that. And finally, when you're in that overdose, and I call it the catharsis, then you, you're out of town. You're out of body. And a very peaceful, blissful feeling comes over you. And there you let go. From the beginning to the end, but you let go a lot at the end. And that's where you ventilate, actually, your body from trauma, from abuse, physical, mental, any abuse. You just ventilate it, and it's gone. It's out of your system. So love can come in again. And, where love is, there's no fear. All your fears get out of your system, and you allow yourself to be yourself, to be who you really came on earth for. And that is, I think, the most important. I'm not directing you. I'm not telling you what to do. The only thing I'm saying is that you have to breathe. That's all I do. And I sing, and I do mantra, do didgeridoo, so that you feel good during the session. And that's what it is. And every time people come back, so it has to do something, isn't it?
And you do these every day. Is there a recommended amount of these sessions that you do every day?
No, but I start at 10 o'clock. I do first my own session in the morning, every morning. And then I start at 10 o'clock and I work till 10 o'clock, nonstop. I do 4 to 5 people, sometimes 6. It depends on how needy the people are. I just wrote something down. Do not wait until you're sick to start your breathing sessions, because it's much better when you do it preventively, then you don't have to get sick.
Your book is filled with stories of different experiences with people, different people's experiences.
Well, there are a few. There are, I think, about 15 or something. Different people with different illnesses, with different diseases. But then I get people that have cancer and are on chemo. And that's very difficult to get people out of that state. They better come before, you know, before they have chemo, before they have all these treatments. I only can help them to pass over easier. And that is not really my purpose in life, because I believe in living forever.
And so you have healed people with cancer through these breathing sessions, these, as you call them, what, rebirthing? Sessions?
Rebirthing, yes. I've not healed. They have healed. I have helped them heal themselves. Because they breathe. They do the breathing. I just tell them to go on breathing when the fear takes over. You know, while you're breathing, all of a sudden all these fears from before, they come and peep under your skin and they want to manifest and they want to resist and stay in. And I say, no, we go through it, and you breathe through it, and then really you see how people come out of the session. They look like they come out of heaven, and that's it. That's what, at the end of the session, you have the feeling of you're in heaven.
Because, as you say, we are nothing but a cluster of vibrating cells getting life from love or dying from fear. So you're rejuvenating all these cells. You're giving life
Absolutely.
To the cells?
Yeah, that's what we're doing. That's what I help you do to yourself.
And so in the process, the cells are rejuvenated, new life, the body has new life, so healing
Yes.
can occur.
Absolutely. And you do it all yourself. And that is the biggest reward is when you come out of your first session, is that everything that you felt, you went through it yourself. You did it yourself. It's not me. It's not the pill. It's not the doctor. It's not the surgeon. It's you did it. And you feel everything. You're very conscious about everything. So that makes it a very, very interesting trip that you're doing. It's a journey. It's actually knowing who you are, what you're afraid of, and why you are afraid of it, and breathing through it, getting it out of your system.
What's your philosophy about death?
Death is there as long as you believe in it. You know, I remember when I first met Leonard Orr, the man that brought rebirthing through to the West. Is that when I first heard him talk about immortality or being physically alive forever, I knew my body was reacting. My chemistry in my body was like jumping for, yes, that is what I know. I know that. I feel that. That is true. That is not lying. That is true. But you got to do it. You know, you got to walk your talk. You can't drink 100 beers and be drunk like I was between my 23 and my 28 and being physically alive forever when you kill every cell in your body. So you got to make up your mind. And I reinstalled all that with the breath.
And, of course, we all know that stress is obviously a very destructive force in our lives. But you say stress alone kills the biggest percentage of our existence. It literally can destroy us from top to bottom.
Absolutely. It makes us, you know, stress makes you fearful of everything, because when you're stressed, you're not concentrated, you're not focused, and then fear is there like a very sneaky snake and comes and tells you, you should do that and don't go there, and it's dangerous, and that's not a good woman for you, it's not a good man for you, it's not, you know, everything that you don't want to hear, then you hear that. And when you have that, you stop thinking, you start to stop thinking, and you start breathing. So when you concentrate on your breath, you're totally in the now. You cannot breathe 1 second earlier, nor can you breathe 1 second later. You're always in the now while you're breathing, that conscious connected breath. So you're really connecting with who you are, your higher self, your divinest being. You're in alignment with your godness. And that's why healing comes in, because, you know, there's one spot where we all can go to. And when we connect to that spot, and we're not staying in the stress, and we're not staying in the matter, in having a car, having a house, having money, having just being with yourself and feeling, going to that spot where really you feel that everything is there for you, but I have to allow it in. And it's fear that doesn't allow it in. When I was 31 or 32, I shaved my head bald, and everybody said, you're crazy, and they're gonna do things to you, and you remember all the Nazis here and all the... I said, I don't care. I want to be bald now, and I want to cut off all the memories that are still stuck in my hair. And I did it, and then also I was breathing already. So I'm not afraid of doing anything, whatever so ever. I've put people on stage, and now I'm singing myself on stage. I made a record, and I'm sorry I couldn't send it to you, but I will send it to you as soon as I'm in the States in September. I will send it to you so you can listen to it and play it. I did everything myself, and I can't write a note, I can't write play an instrument. I just did it. I am not afraid of what other people are thinking.
Right, and it's so important to joy in life is not to worry about what other people are thinking.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there a lot of stress comes from it. What is my dad going to think? What is mom going to think? What is the teacher going to think?
Well, I was just kind of wrapping up here, Mary Rose. You're very intriguing and incredibly successful in not only your philosophy, but obviously in your practice, because you're helping many, many. You've helped yourself be reborn, this rebirth through breathing. And your book, Breath, The Ultimate Secret to Life, Mary Rose Wendells. Mary Rose, tell us how to get your book.
How to get my book on Amazon? It's the easiest. You have it in how do you call that, ebook, and you have it in written mm-hmm. book for $11. I think it's about $11 for the book. So if you get that book for yourself, for me, my first rebirthing session was the nicest present I've ever given to myself. Just try it. Do the step to yourself, because that is what we're afraid of. We're not afraid of all the others. We're afraid of ourselves, to be ourselves. So just do the step, go to the store, buy the book, and find yourself a good rebirther. Do some sessions with a good rebirther, and you will be able to help yourself, to heal yourself, and to do everything you want in your life, the things you've even never thought you could do.
Well, we can feel your passion, Mary Rose. Thank you so much for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so very much. Thank you, Steve, and thank you everyone who is listening to me. Breathe and don't forget it.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome.
She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Breaking the Emotional Health Barriers. And the author is Dr. Ruben Peary. And Dr. Peary joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Dr. Peary.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. We want to welcome you all the way from Melbourne, Australia.
Yes, from down under.
Down under. Well, we're going to help people not to be under the weather, as they say, sick all the time, because yes. You have a very, in the medical circle, you have a very unique view of what causes disease. And you're going to talk about emotional intelligence and how our emotions are a major factor in the causation of illness. So before we get into the details of, because of all your research and all the patients that you work with, tell us something, give us a little background on yourself, doctor, and what brought you to this point to write your book.
Yes, well, I was brought up mainly by my grandparents, and the major driver in my orientation really was my grandfather was a healer of some sort. He was mainly a herbs man. He dealt with herbs. He dealt with natural therapies, and frequently he would talk to me like, I would say, well, so what's the cure for this? And he would say, well, it's all in the mind. And I say, well, are you saying this is a cure? It's not a cure. He says, well, it's a cure if you believe it's a cure. He sounded evasive to me initially, but as I grew old and I got into the medical profession, I realized what he meant, that really it's all in the beliefs of the person holds about a therapy, and that the state of mind of the person is what determines whether they stay well, whether they get out of any illness, whether their general state of health is determined by their intelligence in a way, which I refer to as emotional intelligence, and other authors too refer to it as emotional intelligence too. See?
What we believe about ourselves often then comes true. If we say, you know, we're just sick all the time, that's what we're going to be. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. In my job, I see people who come to me at specific times of the year. And there'll be a gentleman who says, I know once it's winter, I'll get a pneumonia. And sure, as the sun will rise tomorrow, he gets a pneumonia at exactly the same time. Every year, without fail, gets the same symptoms, gets the same antibiotic, gets well, goes home. So he has this expectation in him belief that that's what winter is for him. He gets his pneumonia and he's fine. And so, yeah, the expectation and belief has got a lot to play in disease causation.
Self-prophecy.
Yes. You could call it that.
Right. So we all know that stress is very, very harmful, and we seem in this modern age to be under a lot of stress. So give us a little bit more on the effect of stress on the body.
Yes. Well, it is my belief that, stress has always been there since the cavemen. And stress has been, I think, a savior for the humankind, because if you were in a caveman and you were faced with an animal wanting to make you dinner, now the stresses and associated with that encounter were very useful in priming your body for flight or fight, depending on how you felt at that time. So you'd get the adrenaline rush, you get all the hormones priming your muscles and your heart, and your brain is alert and everything is really fired up for that one burst of speed. And that saved your life, so that was good. But then what's happened in the evolution is that the threats that we used to face, which we needed that response for, are not there anymore. So we don't face lions and saber-toothed tigers anymore. But the response to stress is still the same. So when we are stressed by, say, a job or anything, lack of money or a spouse or a child, you still get the same intensity of stress. And that intensity of stress is inappropriate, but that's what the body is programmed to do. The mind is programmed to react that way, but I think it's inappropriate because the excessive hormones and adrenaline that are pumping in your system are not going to be, you're not going to be running and burning them off. You're sitting there and stewing in these toxic hormones, and they are essentially destroying your body because they've got nowhere to go. You're not going to run. You're not going to fight. You're not going to sweat them out. You're just sitting there and stewing in this intense, stressful emotion. And that's what leads to illness in most cases.
You talk about the best emotion for your health. So what is the best emotion for your health and why?
Now, you can call it happiness if that's an emotion. So being happy is an emotion that people aspire for. And whether consciously or subconscious, we all aspire to be happy. Whether we know why we want to be happy, we all want to be happy. And that's the best emotion. And there's a good reason for that. That emotion is associated with a state of feeling of well-being. I feel good when I'm happy. I feel energized. I feel like I can take on the world. And I feel that ease, that relaxation. I feel that a sense of maybe belonging, the sense that I'm in control of my life, and so I feel at ease. And that state of being at ease is associated with the release of healing hormones. So instead of the toxic hormones that you get with being angry, fearful, you get the hormones that promote healing, the hormones that promote good health. You see, so that is the best emotion to have. And as I said, I think everyone aspires for that emotion, but it's probably the most elusive also of emotions too.
So when we feel an emotion that is damaging to us, like you were just saying, we stew in our emotions, we're just upset and we're mad and angry and afraid or whatever the emotion is at that moment, what should we do? How do we get rid of it? So because it's so damaging.
Yes. Well, the thing is, there's talk of being conscious of your emotions, conscious of who you are and where you are in terms of your emotions at any time, because people sit there and stew and be angry and things, and they are unconscious of it. They are actually like that, you see. So they don't know that they are like that. So most people walk around being angry, being this, being upset. They get cut off in traffic and they swear and they get this. So you have to be aware in the first place that these emotions, allowing these emotions to be there, is damaging. So once you are aware of that and you acknowledge it, then you take the steps to steer yourself away from that emotion. And this can be as simple as diverting your attention from the annoying scenario or person or object. So you could say, I'm going to go for a run instead of sitting here and thinking about this, or play your favorite music, or call your best friend, or anything, or get your spouse and make love, whatever, anything that is the polar opposite of whatever is happening. You need to be creative, because and you know this, because you're doing yourself a favor. You know, if I allow myself to stay 1 second longer with this emotion, I am causing myself harm. I'm leading myself to grief here. So I have to get out. And so be creative. Find something that makes you happy or would normally make you happy, something, whatever.
So you can generate those hormones that heal instead of destroy. I mean, you want the good hormones, not the bad hormones.
Yes, that's it. Put it very simply, that's exactly what you want. You are, now, in a way, turning off the bad ones and saying, I want to turn on the good ones, and I'm going to make it a point in my day-to-day living to do that.
Right. Oh, boy, that makes a lot of sense. Tell us about this young woman as an example who was suffering from panic attacks. Tell us her story.
Well, see, I used to see her partner or boyfriend, live-in boyfriend anyway, and he would come in and say, well, he had his issues, but one day he says to me, well, I really wish you could see my girlfriend. I said, like, well, what do you mean I wish you could see? Just bring her in. He says, oh, she won't leave the house. And I say, why won't she leave the house? Or she says, oh, she leaves the house, she gets all panicky, she freaks out, she sweats, and this, she won't even get letterbox. So, well, what I did with him was, it was a long story anyway, but try to make short, I said, well, we will try to get her out, if I have to go to her house myself, but I said, let's get her in here. And the major problem was, it took her up to 2 hours to get ready to get anywhere, so she would miss any appointment anyway. So, well, we made a day where we said it didn't matter what time she came in. 2 hours late, 3 hours late, we'll still see her. So we saw her on that day, and we had a chat with her, and we talked about the principle of facing the fear that she had, because anxiety attacks are really fear attacks. So you are afraid of something, but although you don't know why you're afraid and what you're afraid of. And one of the ways of attacking a fear is to just face it. But also, another way is to introduce yourself to the fearful situation slowly in small doses. Like for her, I say to her, look, if you can't go out, well, maybe try make an effort to pick the mail, for instance, because that 50-meter walk to the mailbox for her was sheer terror. Well, so we said, we'll do the mailbox as a start. So we did the mailbox, and she initially wasn't successful, but eventually she could. And once she was past the mailbox and could stop at the mailbox and read her mail at the mailbox, she was able to then walk next door to her girlfriend's house. And then she was then able to go out clubbing on Friday. And then she was able to come to my clinic and be on time. But this took weeks and weeks of work. But, that's how we worked with her. She was one example of the panic attacks exist, but they can be cured by just graduated exposure to the cause of the panic attacks. And also, in a sense, exploring the source of the fear. So we got there.
Right. Very good. Very good example. Let's finish, Doctor, in our discussion about your book, Breaking the Emotional Health Barriers. Let's finish on this epidemic of obesity. Of course, it is out of control. I mean, let's be honest. We see fat people everywhere. I mean, people who are overweight, and I'm not condemning them. I'm just saying it's a fact. And you're saying that it's more of an emotional issue than an overeating issue.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes, you see, it's a question of which came first, the chicken or the egg, because if you become obese, you become emotional about it. On the other hand, certain emotions, say emotions of guilt, emotions of low self-esteem, can lead to obesity. People are have been known to overeat because they are stressed. It's just a coping mechanism. So they are stressed by something, and the first thing they reach for is food. And food has always been a sort of a comfort factor in our lives from the time we were born. I mean, each time you cried, your mother stuck food in your mouth, and that felt good. And you stopped crying, and subconsciously that becomes programmed into the mind in a lot of people, that food is equal to relaxation. Now, so I'm stressed, I'll eat, and I'll feel better. Now, so then they get obese. So the question is, why are they obese? Are they obese because they're overeating? Yes, of course, they're overeating, but what is causing the overeating? There's an emotional factor that's causing the overeating, and including a fear factor. Some people will emotionally create a barrier, and fat can be a barrier, an emotional barrier. So I create this fat surrounding, this amount of fat, which makes me physically more formidable, more like a barrier, like it makes me feel safer. There's lots of other emotional, some of them a bit strange, but you know, like we had a case of one woman where the idea was she was having problems with men, so she attracts men, and somehow things don't work out, and she attracts men. In most cases, sometimes who were already married and things like that, and then she then lets herself get very obese, very fat, because then that makes her less attractive. Then she's not attracting all those men anymore, and she's not being hit anymore. You see, so
right.
all this litany of emotions that people have to deal with is there. But then, of course, not everyone starts off with emotions. Some people just get fat because that's our lifestyle. We don't do much exercise. We eat a lot. We spend too much time on the computer. But once we get to that stage, then we wake up one day and say, oh my God, how did I get here? And that becomes a source of stress now. And unfortunately, right. The stress reaction that you then get by stressing over being overweight leads you to do the very things that you shouldn't do. So you eat more, you do more, you probably exercise less, you get into that sense of despair, it doesn't help, what would it do anyway, everyone else is like that, and things like that, and so you let yourself drift, and then now it becomes an emotional issue. I've seen people who then go into a depression because they've got this fat, which they knew they accumulated whilst they were busy doing a project which was really important in their life, but they neglected their health in the process and got obese. Now they, now that they've got the project done, they've got the money, they've amassed all this wealth, they've done everything, they find they're obese. Now they are depressed about this. How could I let myself get to be like this? I should have known better. See?
Well, Doctor, you've really explained a lot of things in a common sense way and very simply, and your book is written that way. Breaking the emotional health barriers, it just makes great sense. And thank you so much, Dr. Ruben Peary. He's been with us on Indie Book Publishing. Tell us, Doctor, how to get your book.
Well, you can get it online from Balboa Press, or I think Amazon.com is selling it. And there's various other online stores that have the book. So, yeah, just look it up. You'll see there's an e-book format. There's soft cover, there's hard cover, whatever suits your preference.
Well, thank you again for being with us, Doctor.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to at least make my views known, and hopefully people get a sense of what I'm trying to say.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.